Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Trupanion Medical Insurance for Pets is a proud sponsor of Pure Dog Talk. Trupanion helps to take the finances out of the equation, so if your pet is sick or injured, you can focus on ensuring they receive the best care possible. Trupanion is able to pay your vet directly, so you pay less out of pocket. And for breeders, Trupanion has a special offer you can send home with your puppies. Click the link on my partner page to learn more. And don't forget, tell them Pure Dog Talk sent you. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves. And once again, we are blessed to have joining us Dr. Marty Greer. And this is a super important topic that I think everybody is going to find very, very interesting. I know I do personally. We're going to talk about sort of pre-breeding protocols, right? So we're back on our repro topic. And Marty had a great conversation on social media about folic acid, which made me say, hey, let's do this. So folic acid and all of the other things that you need to think about as you're getting your bitch ready to be bred, to whelp, etc. Right?
Right.
Excellent. So where do we start?
We start way before the breeding. And I think that's where a lot of people make their first mistake is they don't really understand the significance of having your bitch in great condition nutritionally and body condition wise and hygiene wise before you're ready to breed. So when you walk in the door and your dog's been in heat for 6 days and you're doing your first progesterone test, that's not the time to start thinking about all these things that we're going to prepare you for.
Right, right. Absolutely. All right. So what is our first marker point? We've decided we're going to breed our bitch and we've got the stud dog lined up and everything's ready to go. When do we start planning?
Well, we start planning about 6 to 8 weeks before she comes into heat with appropriate diet. And we've done quite a bit of talking about diet already,
yep.
So I don't want to go into too much detail on it other than just a few things. But we want to make sure that they're on a good, commercially available, well-balanced diet meant for dogs that could potentially be bred. So that would be an all-stage diet or a puppy or performance diet. I think that's a good place to start. And you want to make sure that they're in a good body condition, so not too heavy, not too thin. We know in sheep and probably deer as well that when the females are a little bit overconditioned, just a wee bit soft, not fat, just a wee bit soft, that they actually have larger numbers of babies that are born. So the does with the deer and the sheep and the goats, it's called flushing in sheep and goats. There's actually a term for it, where they increase the caloric intake just prior to the time that they're due to come into heat. And, of course, sheep and goats can cycle seasonally depending on the breed. So they want them just a wee bit on the fat side, and they know that they ovulate more because your body then is saying, there's plenty of resources. You can have two or three babies, not just one.
Right.
So go ahead and ovulate some extra eggs. So we think that's probably what goes on. It certainly does in the wildlife as well, with, like I said, with deer and does. When we've got a really easy winter, we're going to have more twins and triplets in the spring. So I think that's a good way to think about it. Not fat, just a little, just a wee bit over what you would want for perfect show condition. Or if you're a performance dog, you would probably think of her as fat because those dogs are really
The field trial guys are like, that fat dog.
Exactly. But it's okay at this stage.
Right.
So it needs to be an appropriate diet. It needs to have carbohydrates in it. It shouldn't be a raw meat diet. And it shouldn't be a garbanzo bean pea lentil-based diet because of the phytoestrogens.
Right.
So that's all I want to say about nutrition, not to get too in the weeds on all that, which we've, like I said, covered adequately already. So I think that's a good place to start. The other thing that we want to make sure that we've got the dog started on is folic acid, which is vitamin B9, well in advance of the time that she's due to be bred. So not when she starts her heat cycle. There's evidence that shows that starting at the start of the heat cycle is still helpful. But in humans, we know that the women that are trying to get pregnant should be starting the folic acid several months prior to the time that they plan to conceive. So that's pretty easy to do. You just buy folic acid. There are some vitamin supplements that contain it. Some of the diets contain it, but they probably don't have adequate quantities. I've done quite a bit of reading through the literature in the last little bit, and there's not a really great published dose for dogs overall, but it looks like from the studies that are done on preventing cleft palates in bitches that 5 milligrams per bitch per day is the appropriate time. And it says from 15 days before mating is the IME study, but again, or the Royal Canin study, again, it should probably be more like 2 months prior to the time she comes into heat that you should start that. So it's 5 okay. milligrams per bitch per day, not per kilogram, not per pound, per dog per day.
Got it. So not a huge dose. You really don't need a ton.
No, you don't. And B vitamins, B's and C's are water soluble, mm-hmm. so if you're giving them in excess, they'll urinate them out, and it's not going to cause any harm. The other thing that we encourage people to do is to mix the vitamin with the food instead of just popping it down, because B vitamins being water soluble, if you give it not with a meal, it's going to be absorbed very, very quickly and then excreted out through the kidneys pretty quickly. So you'll see nice bright yellow urine, but it won't really give you the effect that you want by having it in the food and being absorbed more slowly, and then a more therapeutic level is retained in the body.
Good. Good information. Okay, so we've started our B vitamins and we've got our folic acid on board. And can you do a little bit on the connection between a lack of folic acid and potential for cleft palate and other midline, you know, so like the stomach wall doesn't close and all those kind of things?
Right. A lot of the midline defects are probably related to a B vitamin deficiency. So cleft palate is one midline defect. There's also cleft lips. There's spina bifida. There's open fontanelles. Questionable whether umbilical hernias are included or not because they're on the ventral body wall, not the dorsal body wall. So there's some discussion about the involvement that way. But we've seen open abdominal walls in the same puppy that has a cleft palate that has spina bifida. So you can certainly see multiple midline defects in the same patient at the same time. And of course, that's pretty catastrophic. So yeah, and it looks like there is a genetic component to cleft palates. There's some studies that indicate that there are certain breeds that the incidence is higher. They're not just the brachycephalics, although those are the most prominently discussed. That would include the English Bulldog, the French Bulldog, the Pug, the Boxer, the Cavalier, King Charles Spaniel. And then we get into some of the non-brachycephalics. Nova Scotia duck-tolling retrievers are pretty prominently represented here. Westies, Collies, German Shepherds, Chihuahuas, my own Corgis, I've seen them in those. So there's some interesting studies to look through. So if you're really interested in reading more about this, you can certainly take a look online. You can look at Google Scholar. You can look at a lot of places and find some pretty important information.
We'll try and put some links, too.
Right, for sure. So in the breeds that are predisposed, it looks like somewhere between 50 and a 70% reduction can be seen in the incidence of cleft palates if the folic acid is given at the right dose at the right time. So early enough and at the right dose effectively works. However, there was a study done at guide dogs where they did a study in a much larger group of dogs. They used 111 breeding bitches at the same dose of the 5 milligram of folic acid a day. And those are Golden Retrievers, Labradors, and Lab Golden Crosses, and they did not see a reduction in the incidence of cleft palates. They have a low incidence to begin with, and they didn't see that go down. So the question then becomes, is there a breed predilection that you can overcome to a certain extent with the environmental changes of folic acid? So I think that's really an important distinction to make. Boston Terriers, there was a really nice study in that in Australia or New Zealand, and it showed a 76% reduction in the risk of cleft palates. So that's huge. I mean, to go
huge.
From like a litter of four puppies, if you have all four puppies affected, instead you have one instead of four, it's still sad. It's still tragic. But my goodness, you can live with,
right?
You know, at least you're saving most of your litter. It's a grand improvement over what we were doing without the folic acid.
Right. Okay.
There are certain teratogenic drugs that should be seriously avoided during pregnancy, especially the first two trimesters of the pregnancy. And those are going to be, and this is kind of hard to get your head around, but vitamin A and vitamin D excesses can cause cleft palate. So one of the first questions that we ask, that I've been asked when I've talked to a geneticist about puppies that have cleft palates, is did the bitch get an excessive amount of vitamin A or vitamin D in her diet? And one of the excesses can come from feeding excessive amounts of liver during pregnancy. So I think that's important, especially for people that are doing homemade diets that aren't doing a kibble type diet, or people that are picking up vitamin and nutritional supplements and thinking that all vitamins are safe and bigger doses are better.
Mm-hmm.
A, D, E, and K are the fat-soluble vitamins. They are not excreted. If they are present in excessive amounts, they build up in the fat in the body. So it's really important that we avoid the vitamin A and vitamin D excesses. Also steroids, corticosteroids, which are going to be things not just like prednisone that you would think of, but it also includes the topical eye and ear medications that contain steroids. So don't think that it's okay to put it in the ear just because it's going in the ear and not going in the mouth. It still can be absorbed systemically at a level that's high enough to cause a cleft palate. or multiple cleft palates in a litter of puppies. Also, the anti-epileptic drugs like Phenobarb, Griseofulvin, which isn't used as much as it used to, but it's still used more in cats than in dogs for ringworm treatment, aspirin, believe it or not, aspirin and viral infections. So it's important that you're thinking about all these things as you go along, and there's an easy-to-find list available of these drugs that you should avoid. Also, trimethoprim sulfa, sulfonamides, Albon, those products, those can also cause problems. So if those are given during the pregnancy, folic acid needs to be given to counteract the effects of that. So it's best just to avoid drugs that we think might be teratogenic. So the general rule of thumb is, unless you know it's safe or unless it's going to improve the quality of the pregnancy, avoid it during the first two trimesters of the pregnancy. So that may mean certain heartworm and flea and tick medications not to be avoided, but to be given timed according to when the bitch ovulates and when the first fetal development is happening.
Interesting question here, and this is based on anecdotal information. My mother, for years and years and years and years as a Clumber Spaniel breeder, gave a tablespoon of liver every day from like 6 weeks on. That helped, she believed, give her better birth weights. Thoughts on that?
I don't think that there's any risk to it, and if she saw a good success, the rule of thumb is if it's working for you, keep doing it. So if by that point, the cleft palate risk is reduced, so even that small amount of liver wouldn't be of concern.
Okay.
And you certainly want decent birth weight puppies, because we know low birth weight puppies puts the puppies at a very significant increased risk of death, and we can go through that at another long discussion that we can have about neonatal care.
Right. Okay, well, that is good. So let's talk a little bit, just a conversation talking about, do we save those cleft palate puppies or not?
Right, and this is a really difficult decision to have to make. I have, over the years, seen a few people try to save them. Most people decide not to try to save them. I know some of the rescues are working hard to save some of the cleft palate puppies, and it's a really tough decision to make. When you have a litter of puppies that otherwise is a large litter, and you're going to need to spend a lot of time really devoting yourself to making sure that all those puppies get good care, I think it's a little bit easier to let a puppy go than if you have a single or a very small litter of puppies with cleft palate in it. I personally had a litter of puppies born a number of years ago. Out of the eight puppies, three of the corgis had cleft palate. My husband walked into the surgery room and said, "You're going to euthanize them, right?" And I said, "Oh, I can't euthanize half my litter. I just can't." I was finishing the C-section. So I said, "I just can't do it." So he's looking at me like, "You know, you're a little crazy." So I worked very hard. I saved one of the puppies. The first two puppies died in the first 24 hours. They were septic. I had postmortems done on those. They were septic as well. The third puppy I got as far as 8 weeks of age. He was in surgery for his cleft palate to be repaired, and at the end of the surgical procedure, he arrested and died. It was a beautiful surgical repair done by our surgeon. Just a lovely repair, but unfortunately, the anesthesia was more than he could take, and it turned out when I did a postmortem on him, sent it off to UPenn for diagnostics, he had a cardiomyopathy and enlarged heart. So it's felt that a lot of these puppies associated with the cleft palate have other defects. It's not unusual to see that. The other thing is, some of these palates can be too short. There can be other swallowing defects that can be affected. So there's a lot of complications. It's not just as simple as saying that you have to tube this puppy six times a day until it's ready for surgery, because you can't let these puppies eat anything orally. They can't nurse because milk will come out of their nose. They'll aspirate it. It'll go down the wrong way. If they try to eat solid food once they're old enough to be weaned, it gets up into the nasal passages, and again, it gets aspirated and causes aspiration pneumonia and sinus infections and a lot of complications. So they're challenging to raise. It takes a huge Herculean effort to keep these puppies alive, and keeping in mind that they may have some other defect as well that's going to complicate your life. So some of them may never swallow normally, even after the repair. Now, the repairs have improved. It used to be that we would take the puppy's surgery and make the edges a little bit fresh, and there's all kinds of surgical procedures written about and how you do this and how you keep scar tissue from happening and all the other appropriate things you have to do for surgery. But now what they're doing, and when I've talked to the veterinary school here in Madison, and I'm sure the other advanced veterinary schools, and it tends to be in the dental surgical department that does this, that they'll put in an acrylic plate underneath the tissue. So they'll lift up the mucosal tissue, put a plate across the defect, the bony defect, and then suture the tissue back over it. I've actually got one client that currently is raising a puppy. She's a dentist, and she was all on board with saying, "I'm not going to euthanize my cleft puppy. I'm going to keep her going, and I know that she's going to be okay because I'll be able to provide the kind of care and the surgery that she's going to need." But it's huge. It takes a lot of work. And like I said, there are often other abnormalities, including with it sometimes a facial cleft, sometimes defects in the nasal bones, the other associated tissues. So it's not a clean-cut issue. Now, most of the time, these are cleft palates, and I've got a picture up on our Facebook page that we'll share with your listeners as well,
right,
that you can see that it's a full-length cleft. Occasionally, we'll see just a small cleft. Most of the time, if it's a cleft, it's a cleft. There's very little question about it. So my team is trained that as soon as a puppy is born and they're suctioning the airway, they're checking for a cleft palate. And so within about 30 seconds of the time the puppy is handed off to a technician, we're aware of whether this puppy has a bright future or not a bright future. And we can start prepping the clients to make those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, when they've got a litter of 10 other puppies, they may say, I just don't have the resources to take care of one. If it's a singleton, it might be different. If it's one or two puppies, it might be different. But it's a really individual decision, and it's one that everyone has to make on their own. And it's probably a good idea to think this through before you have a litter, so that if this happens to you, you are not emotionally and mentally unprepared for making tough decisions the day that a puppy is born.
Yeah, I also been through it with a litter of pug puppies, actually, and I tend to be of the school that Mother Nature said this puppy isn't going to make it, and I don't argue with Mother Nature. And actually, one of the techs at my clinic had wanted to have one of the puppies. Well, she wound up raising both cleft palate puppies successfully. I'm like, you are a better woman than I am. It was amazing. She really put a ton of time and effort into those two babies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's around the clock here for
yeah. The
first 8 weeks of their life. It's very challenging.
Yeah.
So I certainly support anyone that decides that they want to support a cleft palate puppy, but I'm also going to be supportive if they make the decision that they're
right. Just
too limited on their own physical abilities and resources, whether it's because they're a job or they have a job that's demanding or whether
mm-hmm. They're
retired. If they know their limitations.
Right.
And it's okay to let a puppy go. As long as you do it appropriately, you know,
right. Do
it at the time that the puppy is very young, euthanize it. But it is tough, and breeding is not for the weak of heart. There's just no question that you have to be kind of a tough person to get through some of the tough decisions that you have to make.
I think that is an absolutely solid statement. It is definitely not for the weak of heart. Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. I'm so excited, and I just can't hide it. Yeah, I know, I promised I was never going to sing again, but I'm saying, our new audiobook is available now. Woo! Yeah! Pure Dog Talks, How to Stack Your Dog and Other Important Talks is a 2-CD set featuring early mentoring episodes from the podcast, tips, and previously unrecorded pep talks. This is a power-packed opportunity for folks who don't want to search our exhaustive 260-some-odd episode library for just the topic they're looking for. This 2-hour series is a great resource for breeders and mentors, 4-H leaders, anybody that's looking for a straight-line trajectory from what kind of dog should I get to raising a show dog, how to stack and move with your dog, to counting championship points for your new dog. Super easy to purchase. Just drop PayPal $25 a book to Laura at puredogtalk.com and make sure audiobook is in the comments and that your mailing address is included, because shipping is free. That's on me. And I'll have it to you in just a few days. Breeder and mentor bundles are available. I'll give you a 10% discount on 5 or more. And this is a very limited print run. So get your order in today. May not be here tomorrow. Okay, so we've gotten our bitch on proper food and proper supplements and not other supplements.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And then there's a few other things, right? One of our staff's pet peeves is to have a female come to the practice ready for her breeding, ready for a surgical breeding, transcervical breeding, her C-section, and she's dirty, she's got bad odor, she's messy around her pants, she just hasn't had good personal hygiene provided. And if you're not able to keep the dog clean, then you need to at least consider bathing frequently.
Right.
It's really important that we do that. And in fact, I was running a little bit late this morning on my way here to talk to you because I took time to run back into the house. I was picking up the clippers to take it back to the practice, and I went, oh yeah, I need to shave that little bit of stuff off my female that's pregnant. So off her little hind end, she was a bit messy.
Yeah.
So I just really think it's important that we have good hygiene. You can have good hygiene in kennels, you can have good hygiene in homes, but I see some dogs that come in, that are living with people that are really just shockingly not clean. So it's really important. You wouldn't go to surgery yourself. You know, there's very strict instructions on what kind of preparation has to be done before you have a surgical procedure, especially if it's something like a joint replacement. So if we're going to be doing a major abdominal procedure on your female, you want to make sure she's clean. You want to make sure when she starts nursing the puppies that she's clean. And we take great care to make sure that those things happen. We don't want a contaminated wound. We don't want any kind of infection from something that you simply could have done by 2 or 3 days before she's due to whelp, or 2 or 3 days before she's due to be bred, that you get her cleaned up. You don't have to have a professional groomer, but at least get him a bath and make sure that the hair is off of the vital parts of the body that we're going to need to work on.
We call that a sanitary trim.
Yes, yes, we do. Mm-hmm. There's other terms for it as well, but we'll just leave it at that.
We go with sanitary.
For sure.
I think it's a great point. And like I said, when we were off air, it just happened to me. And I mean, my dogs are always clean and tidy. And nope, this one particular bitch I took in for an ultrasound had been out running around in the mud and the dirt and had not gotten a bath. And I got side eye for my veterinarian.
Yeah. My dear husband, after one of my corgi bitches had a litter 3 days after she had the puppies by C-section, he had her out in the pasture helping him load sheep into the trailer. We did have a conversation about sanitation at that point as well. And as a dairy practitioner, I would have thought he would be more sensitive to the fact that you do not want contamination on the mammary glands because of the risk of mastitis. But apparently that...
And they're low to the ground. She's going to be dragging those boobies in the mud, man.
Yeah, he said she was very happy to do it, so therefore he could justify her her willingness to jump in and help him with loading the sheep. So, so yeah, it even happens at my house.
I think this is actually kind of a good topic, Marty. Let's kind of riff on this a little bit. Is that contamination when you're nursing puppies? We had a wire hair pointer bitch who would get out and go swimming in the kind of scummy pond while she was nursing puppies. She thought that was perfectly fabulous. And we actually wound up with a puppy, and maybe you can go on this one, that had gotten infection inside the still sealed eyeball. Ooh,
yeah.
That was yucky.
That's a really important topic. It's called neonatal ophthalmia, and it's relatively common. It is truly an ophthalmic emergency. And when the ophthalmologists speak to groups of veterinarians, they do explain that this is a really important thing. I do have a picture of this in my book, and I can send a picture as well. So it happens with bacteria that get behind the sealed eyelid of the puppy. We typically, in the literature, it says that it happens in unsanitary conditions. But I'll tell you, most of the time that I've seen it in puppies in our practice, these have been places that you could have eaten off the floor in these people's homes.
Right.
You know, I know them. I've been in their homes. I know how clean their dogs are. So it's a little hard to understand how that happens. But what you'll see is just a little bit of bulging behind the eyelid, and it'll contain a huge, an enormous amount of pus material behind the eyelid. So it's really important that if you see any bulging, that you get the veterinarian on the phone and immediately you go in for veterinary care and get those eyelids opened. It doesn't cause harm to the puppy's eye development to get them opened early, and I typically have people bring their entire litter in because frequently you'll see bulging in one puppy's eye. You'll open, you know, if you have 8 puppies, you'll open 16 eyelids. You may find 2 or 3 that are pretty significant and several more that are kind of fulminating and given another 24 hours to turn into the same thing. So it's just the easiest thing to do is just say, come on in, let's just open everybody's eyes, get it cleaned up, make sure everything's okay, and then those are treated with an oral and a topical antibiotic therapy starting immediately. So you do not want to wait. I've seen people that have not recognized it. They've waited too long, and then they've lost vision in the eye. I've actually got one client that has a puppy that had it in both eyes, and sadly, that puppy is blind. So it's just not a cool thing to have happen, and
no.
Like I said, it's related to sanitation, but I don't actually believe that it's just because you're not perfectly sanitary, because I've seen it in places that I know are very, very clean.
No, like I said, this one, you know, she was clean in the litter box. Everything in the whelping box was clean. But she would go out and she would get running around like you're talking about the sheep herding. She wanted to go chase the ducks in the pond. She didn't care that she was nursing puppies.
No, I mean, like, how do they even know that that's not something they're supposed to do? And the other thing that came up pretty frequently 2 years ago at all the conferences that I went to, so the AKC Canine Health Foundation and the Therio meetings, all the meetings 2 years ago, they were talking about the importance of good probiotics to prevent some of these conditions, including mastitis, which is an infection of the mammary gland, metritis, which is an infection in the uterus, pyometras and probably this kind of thing as well, is if you can keep the environment filled with healthy bacteria instead of unhealthy bacteria, that you're less likely to see some of these bacterial diseases. And remember that human probiotics are not the same as dog probiotics. So we have different flora in our guts. So try to stick to one that is a dog probiotic. Yogurt's okay to use either way, but get a probiotic that's labeled for use in dogs. There's a lot of really great ones on the market, and they're going to have things like bifidobacteria, blah, blah, blah. Read the label, see what they contain, see how many CFUs or colony-forming units are in each of those products, and don't use old ones. They're bacteria that need to be alive, so it's if you wait too long to use it, then it's going to lose some of the potency. Some of the colony-forming units will be at a lower number than what they've labeled. So pay attention to what you're using and get a good one. Get one that's got some good reviews and that your veterinarian recommends.
And plain yogurt, no artificial sweetener, no fruit, just plain full-fat yogurt.
Yeah, and that's hard to find.
It is, trust
many
me.
Times, yeah. Many times I've had clients, I've sent them to the store and said, go buy an instant pot or a one pot, whatever you want to call it. Go buy one. You can use it to pressure cook your dog's meat in when you're making meat for them. You can make stock in it. You can make yogurt in it. They're awesome. They're $69. Mm. If you don't already have one, then your dog can give it to you for Mother's Day, Father's Day, you know, whatever. Give them access to the credit card and let them go shopping online and buy you an instant pot. But they are tremendously useful tools, and the yogurt that you can make in them, you can completely control the fat of the milk,
right,
the contents of what you're putting in, the sweeteners or no sweeteners, you know, however you want to manage it. It's really a great way to provide the level of care that you want and control what's going into your dog.
Huh. Okay, and here's another one. We're just going to do all the old wives' tale while I got you on here. Goat's milk. Goat's milk.
Yeah. Yeah, for feeding newborns?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, goat's milk, I have used it over the years, and it gives you a really nice weight gain and very little diarrhea with the puppies. But the fat content and the protein content are not what we need for dogs. And the amino acid content is not what we need to prevent nutritional cataracts developing in puppies.
Right.
So you really are better off. If you need something in a pinch, goat's milk will get you through the night. You can get that at a 24-hour grocery that you probably can't get puppy formula. But it's a good idea to get puppy formula as soon as you can. And the commercially available ones now contain the amino acids that are required to prevent nutritional cataracts from developing. With my cleft palate puppy, the one that I had that had the tragic outcome, I did have him surfed prior to the time that he died. And it was a pretty interesting conversation with the ophthalmologist because he could identify which puppies had had the most supplementation compared to the least supplementation in the litter based on looking at their lenses. So I thought it was pretty fascinating.
That is very fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, he's a super astute ophthalmologist. I'm not saying that he's not. But I was pretty impressed that he was able to look at the puppies and say, why does this one have such a significant cataract? Because, of course, I hadn't told him that it was a cleft puppy. So as soon as he identified that, he could, I mean, he really seriously went down the list and said, the least, the most, he could identify it. So nutritional cataracts are a thing, and you will still be able to surf the puppy if you've had nutritional cataracts and the ophthalmologist that you're working with can recognize them. But that's something for you to be aware of and sensitive to, that goat's milk is not the perfect milk for a dog, and it's pretty hard to find a surrogate mother. I'm reluctant to share milk and colostrum between kennels because we just don't know what kind of diseases we may be passing back and forth. So I would stick with one of the commercially available puppy formulas that we know are developed to be nutritionally complete for puppies, because puppies are not goats. Goats
are not puppies. That's a good one. I like that. Okay, so one final one, since we're kind of down this road, colostrum. Let's talk about the importance of it, how soon they get it, how soon it goes away, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, colostrum is just absolutely essential in dogs. Most of the antibodies that dogs and cats have come through the milk and not through the placenta. So it's different than it is in humans and large animal species. Now, the products that you purchase off the shelf that say colostrum, in the formulas, they're typically bovine colostrum, and there is some nutritional support to those, but they don't replace the antibodies that dog colostrum can. So if you have a litter of puppies that are born, and they're born vaginally, and you had 14 puppies, the first 2 or 3 out are going to get lots of colostrum, and by the time the 14th puppy is out, it's been oxygen deprived, it's been squeezed for 24 hours in the uterus waiting for its turn to come out, and by the time it comes out, the colostrum is pretty much sucked down by the first 13 puppies in the litter. So if we have a bitch that's not lactating well at the time that she has her puppies, if she's not lactating well at C-section, if we have a huge litter that we're concerned about the colostrum intake, if we have a bitch that's sick or a bitch that dies at C-section or dies during whelping or post-whelping, and the puppies didn't get colostrum, then you can find colostrum occasionally if you have a friend that's got another litter of puppies that are about the same age, but they've got to be within the first 12 to 24 hours. You can't put them on a bitch that's got five-day-old puppies and expect that that puppy's going to get colostrum. But as an alternative, we can use frozen plasma or frozen serum. Now, in our practice, we keep it in stock in the freezer, and we purchase ours from Hemopet, which is Gene Dodds.
Gene Dodds, right.
Yeah, there are other blood banks that will sell plasma as a colostral substitute. And I know at least at Dr. Dodds' facility, you don't have to be a veterinarian. You can be just a normal person with a credit card, and they will be more than happy to send you plasma, frozen plasma. They'll send it out on ice or dry ice and ship it to you overnight, so you'll have it. And it's good for 5 years in your freezer, so it's pretty handy to keep on hand if you're planning a litter and you're not sure that you're going to have a bitch that's going to be mother of the year and be able to produce enough colostrum.
Right.
So it's a good thing to have around. It's a very useful tool. In the first 12 hours, it can be given with a feeding tube. After the first 12 hours, we give it either subcutaneously or by intraosseous injection, which is like an into the bone, or subcutaneously. It can be given intravenously. And the dose for a newborn puppy is 16 cc's, regardless of the size of the puppy, and that's from Dr. Bouchard's work. So it doesn't matter if you have a 2-ounce puppy or 2-pound puppy, they get 16 cc's. The only difference is how far apart you space those doses, because clearly you can't give as big a dose to a 2-ounce puppy as a 2-pound puppy. So we just spread it out so that it's given, but it is a total of 16 cc's in the first 12 to 24 hours, and if it's more than 12 hours, then you can give it subcutaneously. Sometimes we'll have puppies that are born here that can take, you know, the dose for the stomach content is 1 cc per 1 ounce of body weight. So if you have an 8-ounce puppy, you can give 8 cc's with the feeding tube, and then we'll give the other 8 cc's subcutaneously so the owner doesn't have to take it home and figure it out.
Right.
Some clients are pretty skilled at those things. Other clients look at me like the deer in the headlights, and it's pretty clear at that point that we need to help them out, that sending home frozen plasma.
Sub-Q fluids of whatever fashion are a challenge, and they're particularly a challenge for itty baby puppies. I mean,
they are.
And you can drown them, right? I mean, you can do too much.
You can give too much, right. You can overwhelm their system. You can, you know, have difficulty finding enough loose skin to give it. They'll cry. They'll move around. So it can be pretty overwhelming. So if you're unfamiliar with giving injections, especially of that volume to a puppy that little, then yes, your veterinary clinic can help you out with that. But do give it with a feeding tube. If you can, at least give half of it with a feeding tube. I think that gives us a lot of benefit. Now, I will occasionally use the plasma when the puppies are older than 12 hours old if I have really severe diarrhea. Really, really bad, like coronavirus bad diarrhea. Like they're going to dehydrate and die on you. And there's indication from bovine work. We don't have anything in the dog because most of this just doesn't get done experimentally in the dog. We do have indications from using in bovines that calves with bad scours do benefit from plasma or serum given orally. So it can help even after 12 hours of age if you're trying to treat a local infection in the GI tract. But it's not going to be absorbed at that point. It's just adjusted into proteins if it's broken down.
Fabulous. Oh my gosh. This is a topic we could literally do hours and hours and hours and hours. And, and you know, after 40 years of breeding dogs, every time I talk to you, I learn something new. So I really, really appreciate it. No, I'm serious. I'm dead serious. It's the best thing about my job. I say this all the time, that every single time I talk to anybody, I'm like, that is the most fascinating thing ever. And you just learn something. I love it. It's my happy place. I'm such a geek.
Yeah. It's okay. You should continue to be curious and wanting to learn your whole life, or else you just stagnate. It's great
boring.
To be curious.
I love it. I love it. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Marty. I've interrupted your one and only ever Sunday off, and I'm going to let you get back to it. And I sure appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks for inviting me on.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our Dog Show Superintendents are the hardworking people who make the Dog Show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the Supers desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.